of the Parsons, and these are, we have two cross complaints, so we're going to allocate cross appeals. And good afternoon, please come up.
Good afternoon. Where would you like us to sit, since we're both appellants?
Mr. Blackburn. Okay, right there, and I guess it really doesn't matter, gentlemen.
Well, yes.
And you're Mr. Cravens?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in reference to you, Mr. Blackburn, do you desire to reserve time?
5 minutes, please. Shall I begin?
Yes, sir, you may.
Your Honor, please, I'm Joe Blackburn, and I represent James Leonard Parsons in what was a divorce case tried in the Goochland Circuit Court over two grueling days back in May of 2013. His wife was Ann Parsons, who is here today. There are basically two issues that are involved in this appeal. One is the classification of some property that we claim was separate property that Mr. Parsons inherited from his mother. And the other issue is an issue on a finding by the trial court regarding Mr. Parsons' gross income. And as that relates to spousal support. Mr. Parsons has one brother named Horton Dean Parsons, and their mother, who survived her husband and their father by 4 years, died in 2000. And in her will, she left multiple parcels of rental property to her two sons equally. There are four parcels of property that we are contesting the finding of as being marital property. And those four parcels were encompassed in three executor deeds that are referenced in my brief, and the appendix is referenced there.
Mr. Blackburn, is her will in the record anywhere?
Her will is not, Your Honor. If you look at the three deeds, however, the all three deeds that are the executor deeds reference her will. And I will say this, there's a portion somewhere in the record I read last night where Ms. Parsons acknowledged that he'd inherited these properties. But the deeds are, the first one is found on page 132 of the appendix, and that's sort of the template for all of the deeds. They all really look like that, and it references their father dying. As you can see, there's several whereas clauses that reference their father dying, and then the mother dying, and reference her will and where it was probated and whatnot, and then shows where she devised the interest in the real estate to her surviving children. And at the bottom, on page 132, the deeds recites in a whereas clause where Horton and James Leonard are conveying the interest of their mothers between the two of them. And obviously the purpose of these deeds were, rather than each of the sons owning one half interest as tenants in common of several items of personal property, they just basically swapped it different parcels. Lynn gets one and Horton gets one.
But so, based on this, is it fair to say that it's in the record that her will at least devised the property, all of it, half and half to her two sons, and then as executor, her other son, working with your client, decided how to divide it up?
Exactly, Judge. Exactly. And as I said, there are three other deeds regarding the four parcels in here that do basically the same thing with different parcels.
Your client takes that property as tenants by the entirety, and of course we understand that in and of itself is not evidence of a gift, but that's the way he desires to receive
correct.
That. Is
correct.
That correct?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct. And there was some testimony as to why that was done. Rick Harefield represented Mr. Parsons, and there's some testimony that there was some creditor issues, that Mr. Parsons had some trouble with creditors earlier, and that it was done that way. And the property was later transferred out of the tenant's entirety into what was called a Windsor Trust. And all but they probably owned 25 parcels of property, and all but their marital home ended up in the Windsor Trust when the parties separated, so it was not tenants by the entirety at the time they separated.
Was the wife a beneficiary of that trust?
She was. She's not named, but she was.
And she was the successor trustee, but not the initial trustee, correct?
Yes. And I would like to emphasize that this was property that James Leonard Parsons inherited, and in her brief, they say on page 7, they were inherited not by Mr. Parsons solely, but were inherited by both husband and wife. That I would argue legally is not true, because the moment Charlotte Parsons died, Horton and James Leonard Parsons were seized of each one half tenants in common of each parcel. All the deed does is split the property up between the brothers.
How long from her date of death until that deed was executed to give it to them as tenants by the entirety? How long did the two brothers own it, essentially half and half?
The deed, if Your Honor please, was dated November 27th of 01, and she died December 28th of 2000.
So for about a year, it was owned. It was his separate property along with his brother.
Yes, sir. Almost a year.
And if we move on from that, let's just assume for your argument that you're correct, and we move on from that, isn't that the same property or those properties that were used because husband was a broker and bought and sold property and obviously very, very successful? And wasn't that property leveraged or used in order to obtain loans and that type of thing during his?
I can't tell you from the record whether it was used to leverage property or not, but these four properties that we are talking about here are all owned mortgage free. They are, and we attempted to trace multiple properties in this case. There was a $1.1 million purchase by Horton from Dean of 15 different properties, and two of them Lynn inherited from his mother. But it all got so commingled and in the wash, it was really hard to separate it. But not with these four. There were no mortgages on these properties, and these were traced right back to his mother's inheritance. And the trial court, I think the most telling thing that was plainly wrong that the trial court said was on page 187 of the appendix, where it mentions the fact that because the parcels were conveyed to the husband and wife, that this tenant by the entirety can only lead the court to reasonably infer that the husband wished for the wife to share his interest in these parcels. And that's contrary to the law. 2107.338 says there's no presumption at all. The mere fact that you're jointly titling property. And earlier on page 186
Let me take you back to that. But doesn't the judge, when the division, when it's going about doing the equitable distribution, doesn't the judge also opine that a number of reasons why that it is believed, or the reason that judge believes that that it is marital and there was donative intent and obviously a gift?
He gives these reasons, that the husband was deeply in love with his wife and was a generous person. I mean, I think that if those two reasons prove a gift by clear and convincing evidence, then any time property is jointly titled is going to be concluded to be for purposes of a gift. I mean, unlike the Theismann case, where Joe Theismann wrote his wife notes saying, I've made you a millionaire now, and things like that. I mean, there's nothing here. The testimony here involved the concern about judgments that the court said it would not accept because we didn't put any judgments into evidence, even though we had a lawyer testifying that was the reason for the tenants by the entirety the way it was titled. But the judge certainly said a few other things, but it was really based upon how much he loved his wife and how generous he was to her. And I mean, if
did those properties, the properties that you're speaking of, didn't those properties, didn't he receive income as far as rent income from those properties?
He received rental income.
And wasn't that commingled?
It was. We're not asking for what was commingled because we could never trace it. We're just asking for the properties to be determined to be separate, his separate property, because there's been no proof that it was a gift.
Was wife involved in husband's business?
The court found, and I think the evidence would support, that she was involved in a very little manner, if any.
She had access to everything, though, is that
she had access to everything. He loved her, I don't question that, and he was a very generous man to her when things were going well in marriage.
That's clear from the record.
Yes, and the judge, I think, in his finding references that. The other issue that we're here on is the spousal support issue. The court awarded Ms. Parsons $10,000 a month in spousal support, and the court based that award in part on a finding that Mr. Parsons grossed $40,000 a month. The wife, Mrs. Parsons, put in their last 2 years of tax returns prior to the separation that would show income of about $20,000 a month, and she called their two CPAs to testify as to what the income was. And maybe it's fairly unusual, but it's our position that the trial court pulled this $40,000 figure just out of the air, and it's their position that he pulled it out of the air too. And we're both asking the court to remand the case for further consideration on the issue of income. So,
didn't husband, part of the problems maybe that the circuit court judge had was that husband used, they frequently used through the marriage, and husband used, took out of business accounts what they used for personal expenses during the marriage. Isn't that correct?
He would do that, but they would be accounted for on the tax return. I don't think that's unusual where you have a small business and people are paying everything out of the business account, but when they get with their CPA to do their taxes, they show what they spent personally, and that's thrown in as income. And his income was in the $250,000 a year range and not $480,000.
Did the judge make any credibility findings regarding, he must have obviously if he believed the wife as opposed to the husband in reference to the income?
I don't think the judge believed either of them in a lot of respects. I mean, if you read the first part of his findings, I mean, he basically doesn't believe either of them in a lot of respects. In the specific finding that you're asking about the $40,000, he says it's confusion to the court, and he says that the husband had a lack of candor in documentation regarding his financial affairs. He goes on to say, offers little documentation to support his contention of the amount of his principal payments. I mean, we put into evidence documents that show the principal payment on the many, many loans that he had. They were in evidence. But he certainly says that. But to me, if she puts in the tax return, she calls the CPAs, he really has just pulled this figure out of the air, $40,000. If he doesn't believe Mr. Parsons, he still needs some basis of fact with which to make a finding that his income is $40,000 a month.
Isn't spousal support in the discretion of the...
Spousal support certainly is. I'm not arguing. I'm only arguing this finding. If the finding were correct, I wouldn't be arguing the amount. My argument would be that the finding is not correct, and that's a pretty big consideration of the debtor's ability to pay in how much he makes and how much he's able to pay. I guess in summary, we would ask you to do what they've asked you and refer that back to the trial court. And on the classification of property, if the court agrees with the four parcels that are mentioned in our brief, that's the Epson, Leonard, Millhiser, and the 9 lots, Mr. Parsons should be entitled to pay her about $176,000 less. I said $168,500 in my brief, but last night I realized that the 9 lots in Middlesex, the court gave her 50% of that rather than 25. So that would take it to $176,500. That's basically what, if the decision stands, she will get that was clearly traced to his inherited property.
It's one of the properties that you mentioned. Was that the marital home that ended up being the marital home? I know he received it from his mother from that, and then they added on to it. That's the different property, isn't it?
That's another parcel. That was a river home.
Thank you.
His mom owned a river home, and when she died, Mr. and Ms. Parsons sold that home and they built a bigger home. And
the one on Rockingham Drive.
If the court agrees with us there, I think that's hybrid and some inherited money went into that that Mr. Parsons should get a credit for.
Thank you.
Would remand on the assignment of error 4 for retracing essentially on the Rockingham Road property?
I don't think the 4 need remand. I mean, the dollars of
the Rockingham Road one.
Rockingham Road would. It would, because of the the court found it was entirely marital, and it's certainly not entirely marital. It was part separate, and maybe we could wade through this and figure that out. I think that would be easier on remand, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Craven. I represent Ms. Parsons. It's great to be here today. 27 years ago, the very first case I had in Virginia was a personal injury case against Mr. Blackburn, so it's a little bit of deja vu being back here today before the Court of Appeals against him. I don't think we've had one directly against one another since then. Mr. Blackburn is correct. We both agree that the issue as to support needs to go back to the lower court. But I would ask the court to consider one thing in what Mr. Blackburn has said to you. He said that there was no basis other than to come to this $40,000 figure, that all of the evidence that was submitted pointed to the tax returns which showed this $20,000 figure. Now, I know the court's looked at the record and it's replete with income issues coming in and income going out throughout all of the transactions that occurred here, which gets to the issue both as to the property and the equitable distribution, but also as to spousal support. But speaking just to the spousal support issue, there is plenty of evidence for the court to have determined, and I think the judge said he viewed the $40,000 figure to be a conservative figure. And one might say, how do you get to that conclusion? Well, there were the Hermitage and Hilliard monies that were properties in the Windsor LLC, which were producing $14,165 a month in positive cash flow. The Hampstead unit was producing $31,998 a month in positive cash flow. The Shenandoah units were producing $52,092 a month in positive cash flow. So there is $97,000-$98,000 in positive cash flow being produced just from 4 sets of units, which is clearly how the court came up with a number above the income tax line 34 on your Form 1040. What the court also knows, and there was plenty of testimony taken, but as one owns real estate, and that's what the assets of this family were real estate, well, on every tax form, even though you may be making income, of course, depreciation can occur. So an accountant can utilize properties to depreciate for purposes of taxes that have absolutely no relevance or anything to do with how much money an individual actually is earning and how much money is going into the accounts.
Doesn't the judge talk about adding the depreciation back in at some point?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I would also like to address a point that was made as to equitable distribution. The court did talk about tracing, and though Mr. Blackburn said that it was he and his client that had gone to great effort to do the tracing, that was not the opinion of the trial judge. And I think the trial judge said in his ruling of November 19th, on page 14 of that ruling, any tracing in this case that was accomplished by the wife, not accomplished by the husband and Mr. Blackburn, but by the wife. And I would ask the court to consider that in a determination of how to look at this particular property. When we look at things at the trial court level, who has the burden and who has the ability to produce the evidence? And Judge Beals, you asked about the will. Now, I understand Mr. Blackburn has some commentary about the will and what he views the will may have read, but you don't know, no one in this courtroom knows what that will said because the will was not put in evidence. That would be a pretty good piece of evidence were you wanting to argue that this property had not been transmuted or commingled and that it should stay separate property. That will would be a really good document to have. We don't have that. And I would ask the court to consider in viewing this that the will is not there, but what do we have? We have a judge who did make on the record, once again on November.
Well, can I ask you on that, Mr. Cravens? Even if we don't have the will, we do have this these deeds in the joint appendix that Mr. Blackburn referred to, and it's pretty clear. I mean, let me ask you this: do you dispute in any way that Mrs. Parsons, the mother, left her estate to her two sons?
I do not dispute that she left her estate to her two sons. I will tell you in conversations with my client was of the belief that the portion that was provided to my client's husband, Lynn, was provided to Lynn and to her.
In the will.
And she thought she was a recipient equal to Lynn in the will. And that the properties, we start here with these deeds from the trust over to Lynn and his wife, but I think we could look again right there. If there was some point in there that Lynn wanted to keep that property separate, his brother, as the executor, was doing the deeds. There was no indication made and nothing was done there to keep that property separate. And I would point the court to some of the...
But presumably if the property were owned after her death, on her date of death, the two sons were seized of the property under Virginia law, where each owns a portion of it, but the daughter-in-law would not own any. Why, if it's separate property at that point, why would the brother who's the executor deed it to husband and wife as tenants by the entirety, unless he thought it was beneficial to the husband to do it in such a way, such as creditor protection?
It could have been, and I understand that there may have been, because there were numerous transactions that were occurring here. This is not a real estate situation where there's one or two or three transactions, Your Honor. There are multiple transactions going all the time. And there actually could have been some creditor issues that occurred there. But none of that creditor evidence, as pointed out by the trial judge, was ever put into evidence either. And the trial judge was very skeptical of the testimony that was provided by a member of the bar, and he was skeptical on the record of that testimony, which, in my review of this, I found fairly compelling. Why was the judge not believing this? Well, I think part of that is it appeared to me, in having reviewed the record, that there was some great disdain about the credibility of each party going through this process and the evidence that each party was providing to the judge. And the court merely looked at the properties themselves and says he loved his wife very much, he doted on his wife, he gave his wife everything she wanted, they shared all of the accounts, he ran this Windsor Trust account like a personal business finance conglomerate. I mean, we have expenditures for a house, expenditures for a roof, and then an expenditure to La Petite Daycare Academy coming out of the same account on a weekly basis. So I think that the court correctly viewed that all of the assets had been commingled. These assets had been commingled since roughly 2002. So there was a 10-year period of this commingling and leaning assets and borrowing on assets.
Mr. Cravens, but before we get to the alleged commingling, we have to have some donative intent. You know, we have to have for the gift. And what you're basically, if I understand you correctly, what you're basically arguing is that the husband's intent can be implied from basically the fact that he's sharing everything with the wife, and that's what the circuit court judge stated, and that's an implied finding of donative intent. Is that what you're...
That would exactly be what I would argue, Your Honor. I think when we look at the Theismann case, which counsel also cited to, Joe Theismann buys this farm, as the court knows, and he puts his wife's name on it, although he had paid 100% of the farm to himself, and he writes a card to her, "Now it's our home." I'm sure Mr. Theismann's lawyer argued, "I never meant that I was giving away all of my asset to her when I said, this is our home. I merely meant this was a place we could go and stay." But the court in that situation said, if I look at the totality of the circumstances and how they live and how they do their money and how they do their finances, this was an intent to give to this wife half of the property. I would argue here that under the same analysis, when that money comes into Windsor, the property, and it's put as T by E, and then for the next 10 years, all of their accounting is done and all of their borrowing is done and properties are leaned upon, that's clearly commingled. And I would submit to the court that the reason there was no specific tracing done as it would have been impossible after 10 years. And all of the movement of assets in and out of both the Windsor Trust and all of the various accounts that were maintained by the parties, that was simply not possible. Our contention as to the support is that the $40,000 figure was arbitrarily too low. We believe that there was ample evidence presented that the amount of income brought in on a monthly basis by Mr. Parsons was easily over $100,000 a month. And that based upon that amount of income, and the court stating on the record, it was confused by this evidence, stating on the record that none of the testimony of the accountants and the lawyer or of Mr. Parsons himself was helpful because he was hiding that evidence from the court, and he was had a husband had a lack of candor, convinces the court that his $20,000 admitted figure was very low. I think is very good analysis by the court, except to the extent that the court was afraid, I believe, to, and I think the numbers just get very high. I mean, when you start talking about $10,000 a month, and I don't want to say to the court that that's a low sum of money, that's not. But $10,000 a month in a family and in a household that has brought in $100,000 a month plus in income, that is a very nominal amount of money and is not indicative of what we contend that she should have received. I have no further evidence before for the court, but if the court has any questions of me, I'll be happy to answer them.
The properties that are in Husbands of Simon of Error 3, the Epson Drive, Millhauser Avenue, Leonard Parkway, and then the non-lots in Middlesex County, were there loans taken out against those over the years, or did they stay free and clear?
I think all of these properties, Mr. Blackburn is correct, were free and clear, but these properties were all owned together. At one point, Middlesex was sold to purchase a property, Tranquilla, down in Florida. That was after separation, and what was that? Epson Downs, Millhauser, Leonard Parkway. There were nine lots in Middlesex. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact extent of what loans were taken out against them or what liens were placed against them, which is, I think, part of what caused the trial judge some difficulty, because none of that evidence as to the tracing was brought into play. What was brought into play was the evidence that Mr. Biss, who represented Ms. Parsons in the lower court, brought into play, which was that there were all types of loans occurring and liens occurring and property going and flowing in and out of the Windsor Trust. And it was a pass-through corporation, a trust is what it was. And so money was in and money was out. But I would submit to the court that the judge's analysis that this was a transfer to the wife with donative intent was a proper finding.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just very briefly, if you're honest, please. If the trial court said that only Ms. Parsons did any tracing and we didn't, then the trial court, I would argue, there is plainly wrong when you look at these four parcels of property that we've talked about. Mr. Cravens, I can't remember who won that case 27 years ago. I'll have to ask him right now. I don't even remember it. But anyway, Mr. Cravens says that he had conversations with his client. Well, they're not in the record, and the record is different from the conversations she had. On page 15 of our appendix, she is specifically asked, and you acknowledge that his parents died and he inherited some property, don't you? And her answer was yes. She didn't testify then that I thought Charlotte loved me and she was going to include me in her will or anything like that. I think that you've got the deeds, you've got her testimony that Lynn Parsons inherited the property, and I would argue that is sufficient. As to his numbers on the income of the properties, I assume he was getting those numbers from the tax return. There is our tax returns. The tax returns begin on page 67 of the appendix. The 2010 one is on, begins at 67, and the 2011 one begins at page 111. And if you will see big numbers from the standpoint of gross income on those tax returns, but I don't know what Mr. Cravens meant by net income or whatever term he used as it throwing off income, but the tax returns show the net income of the parties after business expenses in the $250,000 range, nothing like what he has suggested.
Mr. Blackburn, Mr. Cravens seems to be arguing with the four properties on your assignment of error 3 for husband that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and that the totality is things were commingled and there were liens taken out against all sorts of properties. Can you help illuminate for the court whether these properties, Epson Drive, Millhauser Avenue, Leonard Parkway, and the non-lots in Middlesex were, had liens against them at some point that were with both spouses' names on there, or did everything stay pretty much free and clear?
Those obviously did not have liens upon them when his mother died. They did not have liens upon them when the parties separated. At some time between 2000, when the mother died, and when they separated, after the deed that transferred them to, as tenants by the entirety, there was another deed that then transferred them into the Windsor Trust, which was basically the business component where Mr. Parsons ran his real estate rental business. He owned probably 300 residential units at the time they separated, and these four were within those 300 residential units. The Windsor Trust incurred debt, and whether or not the Windsor Trust pledged these specific properties as debt or pledged the Hampstead Apartments as debt, I can't tell you to stand
up. Outside of when the Windsor Trust owned them and outside of the time of separation, I understand your answer is there was no lien against any of these properties.
No lien when he inherited from Charlotte and no lien when they separated.
Or when it went to the Windsor Trust.
Correct. It's clear now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cravens, do you have any you had?
No, Your Honor. Nothing.
Very good. Thank you. We will come down and recount.